The last part is the one that we were just, Representative Fletcher was just asking about with the municipalities. There was just one sentence left in the bill that was, that we had, were not able to work out with Maine Municipal Association, and so we are going to delete that. And that was the issue of whether municipalities could adopt ordinances that were more restrictive than the states. And we're going to take that out. We're going to have continued conversations with MMA and others over the summer and see where we get with that. So for now, it's coming out. But the rest of Part G, with the changes we proposed last time, will remain. They were fine with that. So that's a walkthrough of where we are today. The one other thing I did not mention as we went through is we did agree last time to take out Section A8, which is the section that the oil dealers were so concerned about. But what we are proposing, as I said at the last session, is the task force felt very strongly about moving forward with looking at electrification of home heat and transportation because of the efficiencies, because of the energy independence goals, because of the price volatility issues. So we will be asking the committee to send a letter asking us to move that forward, that analysis forward.
Good, Mr. Chairman. There was some discussion originally, way back, it was only last week actually, around whether the interest of the Efficiency Maine Trust in getting involved in the heating conversion, I call it. So I asked the chair of Efficiency Maine Trust, Adam Lee, just to give us the Efficiency Maine Trust position, and that letter is in front of you. And principally what it says is they would be thrilled to do it. They just don't know exactly how it fits into the triennial plan to get it all integrated. But I did not get any sense that there was a non-interest position. It's more of we are trying to get our triennial plan together, and we'll certainly try to do it, but we got to know enough to know what we're going to do type of answer. And, you know, his is much better answer than mine is at this point. So that was in reference to the DEP leading the heating conversion. I say leading the heating conversion, but from what I hear back from Efficiency Maine Trust, they are absolutely interested in being the leader on that project, and I would suggest that we encourage that to happen and that gets integrated into the overall plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Tilburg would remember, and Mr. Burroughs would remember, that in doing the land wind energy bill 2 years ago, I think that was LD 2283, and in working with Ms. Nagoski and Mr. Burroughs on the last year ocean energy bill that resulted in the test sites and all of that, we carried forward into both a paragraph that I believe that actually Ms. Tilburg had written, and I still have the actual slip of paper somewhere on which you wrote it, that made sure that any company that wins a successful bid and places such machinery in the ocean has the financial wherewithal, either in the form of a bond or insurance, etc., to remove the appliances, the energy devices, both on land and in the water. In the fullness of time, the working ones will have to be replaced. Equipment will become obsolete. In the fullness of time, God forbid, we may have a bankruptcy. That means a company otherwise may no longer be operating here, but we cannot leave the machinery in the water because of the circumstances of the navigation and harvest of the sea and all of that. So that wherewithal language, if that could be brought, since we've done it in the other two bills that had to do with terrestrial and ocean energy, if that could be brought forward. I believe the one difference you would find, Mr. Burroughs, is that you would added into that which Ms. Tilburg had written the word inviolate, that is, the fund must be inviolate in some way. I'm not sure that actually has You might have even gotten that from me, so let me take appropriate blame. But I'm not sure that actually has status as a word in law referring to those things, whereas the way it was rewritten into the wind energy bill for land might have covered it. But if that could be brought forward so that we dealt with this before there's rods of steel or floating objects in the water.
Okay.
Essentially a decommissioning fund of some sort, I think was it.
I believe it was phrased in such a high-minded way that it could be a bonding, it could be insurance, could be a decommissioning fund in such a way that in the fullness of time it could be used, and it would have nothing to do with the financial status of the company, meaning if it went bankrupt, the funds would still be there so that Maine could then remove the engines from the water or do what they needed to with them, not have to go to the ratepayers.
We'll take a look at that language and bring it in.
Great. I know I would have, but probably not here, the things that I've said. But you can find it in the law because we've repeated it twice.
Just a small question on that.
Sure.
To the extent that these facilities are located on federal land, that might be a complicating factor that we would need to think about, because that's the high probability that on those contracts that it would be, the generation would not be in Maine. It would actually be under control of the federal agency.
A very good point. I mean, but extend it to what we can. If it's within Maine waters, clearly our permitting would have to require it. And if it's in federal waters, we are the least of their problems if it gets out there. So. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. So I gather, thank you, Mr. Chair, I gather that somebody is going to be working on language there in connection with that point raised by Representative Adams.
Absolutely. If that's everybody's pleasure.
So a small point on that point. There may be parts of these structures that people have come to appreciate because of artificial reef phenomenon. That language shouldn't require that everything be removed. It needs to be done through whatever appropriate process allows an evaluation and the proper environmental result occur.
Representative Blanchard. Could you back me up a little bit and tell me which paragraph you want to remove as far as the fuel oil dealers were concerned? Or you want to write a letter for what paragraph? And what do you want the letters to state?
We're thinking something along the lines that asking some entity to be decided who's the most appropriate entity to continue an analysis of whether electrification makes sense, whether, as homeowners, looking at efficiencies of heat sources and transportation.
Seems like you'd have had that done before you promoted this bill.
Well, we did have it done. We did do an economic analysis that included electrification of using
heat pumps and electric vehicles. We did do an analysis of that, and that's why we proposed Section A8. But in the interest of moving the bill forward, we felt that it was bogging down the bill, but the Ocean Energy Task Force, as I said, felt strongly based on information presented to it.
I can't buy it, because for the simple reason, you ought to go to Fort Kent and see what electric heat would do up to Fort Kent with a heat pump when it's 35 below zero and the wind's blowing at 55 miles an hour.
Right, and that's why, air source heat pumps don't make sense in every circumstance, where a geothermal does, and something else, might be too. Right, and that's why we need more information. So that's what we're asking for, is a more in-depth analysis.
Anything else? We've made some good progress. I think we're there, I think.
Well,
Representative Fletcher?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that there are two or three things I got to get my head around.
Okay.
One of them is the long-term contracting.
Yep.
I understand.
You have some figures, too.
Well, and I just hand-scratched some things out. But I think we've really got to think outside the box, as you always say, on the long-term contracting issue. And because we've been principally had that designed to get good deals, reduce rates, looking at short term, we've signed one for long term wind, land based wind. But I think we're talking about something else. We are talking about prospective with the expectation that it's going to be higher than market. So if you look at my scribbles, and I need the people who really understand it to correct me here. Part of the issue we run into, most of us, include myself, think of a long-term contract. I look at retail price, and we'll just use the example of 9 cents. So I say, well, if we pay 10 cents for this renewable, it's only 1 cent, but it's more than that. Because if I've got it right, if we sign it at a retail rate and direct the T&D to sign the contract, they then have to go back and sell it at a wholesale rate. And the example I've used here is 9 retail and 6 wholesale. So what ends up happening, the T&D goes back and offers that at the wholesale, and we'll say we get 6 cents. The 3 cent goes into stranded cost. That's a stranded cost that the T&D is in the T&D rates and the ratepayers pay it back. But then the competitive electricity provider buys it at wholesale, but then more than likely sells it back at retail. So in a way, for a contract that the competitive electricity provider had no risk with, so to speak, because it's a signed contract between the T&D, but they can't have energy, they then have to sell it back to the competitive energy provider at wholesale, who then charges back at retail. So that profit or net gain is gained by the competitive energy provider. My point is that if we're going to go out and sign long-term contracts at retail rates, we might want to think about how we can avoid this gaming or gain with good intentions, because ultimately the T&D customer ends up paying for it twice, I think. He or she pays for it in stranded cost and then buys it back at retail. And I think I'm suggesting that we need, now maybe I'm wrong on this, and that's why I need the experts to look at it, PUC or whoever, and tell me this isn't the way it works. But if it is the way it works, if we're going to go out and pay retail equivalent prices, that's got to come back to the customer as a contract that isn't sold and resold again. Now, I'm hopefully wrong on this analysis. And that brings me to the whole point that if we're going to go long-term contracts, which may be the right thing to do, to build the industry, then we've got to think of other ways, which is in the bill, of rather than just relying on, as my good chair said, relying on the poor ratepayer in the state of Maine to be the backstop. And I think we need to get a little creative around this, and I threw it out, and I was very, very, very serious in the intent. If this is the right thing to do, and the state of Maine is buying 18 million kilowatt hours a year, which is approximately 20% of what the 25 megawatt farm would generate, let's do it as clean and as transparent and as straightforward as possible. And then have something like a ocean wind green standard offer that people can buy into. The University of Maine, Chinbro, or whoever's building these entities, as well as the citizens of the state of Maine, to say, we can buy in direct, we will buy this at this price, and we've got to get the competitive energy provider out of the middle, because I think they're getting an unearned enrichment. So I throw it out, and I would certainly like critique of that thought, and some way that we think outside the box, because if we're going to do this, let's not just get trapped in the current system. Thank you.
I don't think anyone have any comments about that, but I think that's something to think about.
Well, I think when the it'd be probably worth hearing from either a utility or the PUC when they currently do the long-term contract, like with the First Wind project. My understanding was CMP got some of that energy capacity, and Bangor Hydro got some of the energy and capacity, and they're using that in the market to bring down standard offer prices. So I'm sure there are different models that could be used, and you know, we could have the PUC talk about that. It is in the legislation. As you know, we look to five other sources before we get to the ratepayers. So we agree with you that the ratepayers should be the backstop of last resort. And Dr. Dagger talked about the production tax credit legislation that's in Congress, as well as the federal subsidies for offshore, deep water offshore wind. So we're hopeful that we can bring this price down. When we had the PUC run the numbers, you know, the rate impact we came up with at the presumed price point that we thought that the wind would bid in was about a mil to a mil and a half if spread over all rate pairs. So, and that was assuming a 40% capacity factor.
Anyone else have anything for Ms. Guskin?